The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is the Takeaway podcast for Wednesday, October 12th, 2016. Remember to join the conversation at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And you know, this low brow election has us thinking here at The Takeaway, thinking about whether there's anything that can elevate us, unify us, to get us out of the gutter of division, politics, and instead soar together high into the heavens.
When we set people on Mars, everything will stop. Everyone will watch. Everyone will be seeing the streaming video coming from their cam helmets. Everything will be on them. And the problems will just kind of, for that moment, for that glorious moment, will fade away. For that moment. But then they'll come back, as they always do. But I think you're right. I think we will. It's a unifier.
Gosh, that sounds great, doesn't it? Mars, the human endeavor. That moment in the future when we all realize that we're one species together on one pale blue dot and that we share the same small destiny. Well, that's in the future. In fact, it's at the end of this hour. First, we need to deal with this world, the divided world, and the political world of election 2016. And we're going to start today with the shifting ideas of morality in politics. The political morality that we're used to seems to be playing a different role this year than in the past.
America is great. Because America is good.
There's Hillary Clinton. She's been using that line a lot lately. Her contrast to an opponent she wants voters to see as mean or ruthless, selfish, boorish, definitely immoral. Democrats might not be used to hearing their candidate try to grab the moral high ground in this way. Of course, Donald Trump has his own morality pitch. Hillary Clinton is a liar. Hillary Clinton is a lawbreaker.
And believe me, she has tremendous hate in her heart.
In a few minutes, we're going to hear from an evangelical leader on how Donald Trump has many traits you might not expect your average evangelical to like, but is still maintaining the support of a lot of Christian conservatives. But first, a different look at the shifting role of morality in American politics. Have things really changed all that much? Jeet here actually doesn't think so. He's senior editor at The New Republic, and he says that the more closely you look at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, the more you see that the politics of morality hasn't changed that much at all.
I think that political morality has to have an element of policy, or it's really about how we decide to live with each other. Any human community has to have rules, and we all have our own personal morality, but that's very different than political morality, which is the rules that we agree to live together. So I think that that's the simplest definition of morality, the rules that we come together so that we can exist as a community.
And so in that vein, Jeet, here, we seem maybe not for the first time, but certainly more loudly than in past elections, Democrats and Hillary Clinton in particular, using that very rhetoric of morality as the way we come together and live with each other, as a billboard at the top of the campaign. And we haven't really heard this so much from Democrats in the past.
I don't know if I'd agree with that. Like, I think especially Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, I mean, whatever we want to say about their personal life, I think we're talking about political morality. They've always been moralist. I mean, it seems ironic to say so, but Bill Clinton signed the Abstinence Education Act. There's a strong element of sort of morality of drug testing in the welfare reform. And the whole idea of it takes a village is a very moralistic idea. I think that the Democrats have always been, at least for the last 50 years, sort of have had this communitarian sense of morality.
It takes a village. We support one another, things like that.
Yes. Yeah, so, I think those are all very moralistic statements.
So does it mean now that Democrats are filling a vacuum where there's communalistic, moralistic ideas have more volume because they think they're running against a candidate who is morally vacuous or mean or doesn't fit the moral profile of his own party and they just have an opportunity now?
Well, I would actually sort of step back and say, as perverse as this sounds, I think Donald Trump is a moralist. Because if we go say that morality is the rules that we live together, I actually think that he's articulating a very strong morality, which is sort of hyper-individualistic patriarchy.
So then we have to contrast that clearly right away with the type of morality and moralizing that we're used to in Republican politics, right? You're saying that Donald Trump is actually projecting a strong morality, but there's yes. part of it that's in direct contrast with the moral politics of the right that we're used to. Donald Trump is new to being pro-life, of course. He's married three times. He's acknowledged lots of adultery and sexual behavior throughout his whole life in the media. So there's a contrasting morality there that he has to reconcile.
My take on Trump, which is a bit of a counterintuitive take, is that there's less new there than meets the eye. I mean, there are certain people, conservatives like Ross Douthat of the New York Times, who say, well, he's a sort of post-religious conservative. He's a playboy Republican. He's a hustler Republican. But I think that actually misses something very crucial, which is that there's a continuum in patriarchy. He is articulating a patriarchal vision. I think one thing to say about Donald Trump is that he doesn't bring something new, but he is unvarnished. He reveals what was already there, but sort of masked. He's offering patriarchy without the mask of chivalry.
So it seems to me then that maybe what Donald Trump is doing here, given that he is running at the top of the Republican ticket, is taking Christian nationalism, which has been at the center of Republican politics, and just shifting the emphasis more towards the nationalism, less from the Christian. But it's more or less the same thing?
Yeah, I think that's right. Although I'd even go a little bit further than that, because, I mean, he always talks about Christian stuff, and he's actually called Hillary Clinton the devil more than once. And I think that there are actual followers of his, like Alex Jones, who actually do think that Hillary Clinton is a demon from hell and has said that she, like, stinks of sulfur. So that's a moralistic vision. And the Christian conservatives are a huge part of his coalition. And there's some younger Christians, evangelicals, to give them credit, at Christianity Today and The World magazine that have disavowed Trump. But if you look at it, like, I think about 80% of white evangelical Christians are going to vote for Donald Trump. And, you know, this sort of libertine who mistreats women. And I think the only logical conclusion I can draw from that is that he actually does embody their values. And some of them justify this, Sean Hannity has, by saying, well, you know, King David had 500 concubines. So in a sense, Donald Trump is a biblical patriarch. That is the ideal of patriarchy, right? That you have one strong man who's the father of the family who can, you know, take as many women as he wants. So Donald Trump is old-fashioned religion in the classic sense.
The shifting politics of morality in America. Jeet here says, actually, they haven't shifted all that much at all. We're getting exactly what we've always gotten, just maybe a little bit easier to understand. Jeet here, senior editor at The New Republic. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So some more now on this discussion of morality in election 2016. You just heard Jeet here of The New Republic. He thinks nothing has really changed, but you wouldn't know it listening to this.
Moral Majority is not a religious organization. The fact is that it's political. It's a very political organization, and one's membership is based upon citizenship in this country and a commitment to a pro-life, pro-traditional family, pro-moral, and pro-American position.
That's Jerry Falwell defining the moral majority way back in 1979. Ronald Reagan relied on the conservative religious coalition to win the Republican nomination in 1980 and, of course, the presidency. Evangelicals helped the Republican Party win the House and Senate in the 90s, and George W. Bush, himself an evangelical, relied heavily on those faith-based voters to win his two terms. And there's no doubt that evangelicals are still a key part of the Republican coalition. But here comes Donald Trump, the three times married, very recently anti-abortion, money accumulating real estate mogul from New York City. Republicans nominated him. And so that leads to the evangelical question. Does the GOP no longer care as much as it used to what Christian conservatives think? Gabe Lyons is the director of Q Commons, a learning community that mobilizes Christians to think well and advance the good in society. And he joins me now to talk about the role of Christianity in this presidential election. Gabe Lyons, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
As you know, there's been a lot of criticism of evangelical leaders and some voters for getting behind and staying behind Donald Trump, not just these recent Access Hollywood tapes, but going back to the beginning, you know, three times married, admitted adulterer, long history of what Christians might consider less than moral behavior, pro-abortion rights until very recently. There's been some criticism of evangelicals and Christians then getting behind a candidate like that.
Yeah, there has been, and it's very understandable because, you know, he certainly Donald Trump doesn't fit the profile of a typical candidate that Christians would rally behind. And I think it just goes to show how much our entire country is currently not satisfied with these candidates. And so certainly that's playing a role in how people of faith are also thinking. And some of the criticism that's coming at evangelical leaders, not only for voting for Trump, but I think it's coming because they're advocating for Trump. They're saying, this is what Christians should do. If you're being a faithful follower of Jesus, then you should put your vote here. And I think that's what's really putting a bitter taste in a lot of people's mouths.
What do you think has happened then in your camp with the evangelical leaders who, as you said, have not only said they're going to vote for Trump, but advocate for Trump?
Well, I would first want to just say there's a lot of evangelical leaders who are not supportive of Trump. But for those who are, I think there's a political calculation going on. They care deeply about religious freedom, deeply about pro-life. And they're essentially saying, I'm not sure I can trust Donald Trump, but he's at least talking a language that we understand, and maybe there's a chance he'll hold up these things, whereas we know 100% that Hillary Clinton will not. We know that she will nominate Supreme Court justices that don't stick to conservative principles the way most evangelicals would like to see the courts go. And so I think that's what's happening in the political calculation.
There's this political world almost, Gabe, swirling around the core beliefs that you're expressing about how morals should be reflected in politics. And right now there's this moment where really neither candidate is doing it. And I get back to my point before, which is it seems to me like evangelicals, whether they vote for one candidate, the other candidate, or none of the top candidates, get to sort of make political decisions like everybody else does. Sometimes we don't expect them to do that.
Well, no, I think they get to do that, but I think we should be very thoughtful about what our decisions cause. What are the consequences of a vote? It's not only to gain more numbers for a particular candidate, but it actually emphasizes and endorses certain behaviors. It says to the entire electorate, it says to our politicians, this kind of behavior is acceptable and we want more of it. And so I think we have to understand the consequences of our votes and also recognize as people of faith that we've got to do the hard work in our communities. That's why tomorrow night our Q Commons event, taking place in over 100 cities in the U.S., is actually convening these town hall meetings where people are coming together in order to address concerns of racism, talk about this election, go deeper and be thoughtful, not just sort of reactionary, but actually be a part of solving these problems by engaging one another, listening to one another, and even when they disagree, saying, let's find some common ground, because let's face it, on November 9th, that's going to be the moment where the hard work's going to begin for this country to start to heal and to try to bring itself back together.
Gabe Lyon is the creator of Q Commons. That's a learning community that mobilizes Christians. And Gabe Lyons, I appreciate you joining us.
Good to be with you.
This is Jim Froman from Lincoln, Nebraska. Both parties only care about getting and keeping power. Anything goes in order to achieve this power. I am now a registered independent.
And we've been asking you if the values and the morals of the Republican or the Democratic parties have changed over the last few years. From Huntington, West Virginia, I used to vote Republican on most issues, but as an atheist, I hate how they've taken on organized religious causes over the last few decades as their own. I don't mind if a politician is religious. I just don't want to hear about it or have it affect policy. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. Southern Haiti is still reeling from the destruction caused by Hurricane Matthew last week. The death toll, several hundreds, in some places reported up to 1,000, and nearly 200,000 people are living in shelters. The hurricane spared the capital city of Port-au-Prince, but devastated the country's southern peninsula, particularly the remote villages there. Aid organizations are having a hard time reaching those remote areas, and there's a growing fear that the country will see a resurgence of cholera, which has killed thousands of Haitians since the earthquake in 2010. John Hassey is National Director of World Vision Haiti. He joins me now from Port-au-Prince. John, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What are the most urgent needs in Haiti right now?
The greatest needs are really clean water. Like you talked about, the cholera is just a real concern for everybody here on the ground. The second is, you know, we're still in the rainy season. So at night, you see the rain coming. During the day, it's a beautiful day today here in Port-au-Prince and down in the south, as I've talked to our teams. But in the evening, it's going to rain. And so keeping people out of the elements, keeping them, you know, out of the rain and protecting them from flooding. So emergency shelter. And then many organizations, including World Vision, have already started providing food to people. So just meeting people's basic needs are still in that emergency phase. So we're trying to meet people's basic needs.
Avoiding cholera right now at this moment, does that mean trucking water, if you can, to these remote villages so that they have clean water to drink and to use?
I know that several organizations are. World Vision is providing chlorine tablets, you know, and other water treatment mechanisms to people, helping them be able to collect their water better and making sure that it's safe for their consumption.
John Hassey, what is at the root of the threat of famine here? Is it lack of transportation? Is it destroyed infrastructure? Lack of aid in the first place? What's at the root of this?
Well, I think, you know, famine's a very strong word. And I think that really what's happening is we're in the place now where crops have just been destroyed. It's just as many of them were about to be harvested. And so people, as they're going into the next few months, aren't going to have just enough to eat. And so World Vision, and I know I've been talking with donors and other groups, we're all concerned around just in the next coming weeks, actually even right now in many areas, is the planting season. And so people's crops and their seed reserves have been destroyed. And so we're rushing to try and get as many seeds out to and agricultural supplies out to these farmers as possible. Many of their fields, as we've heard, have just been destroyed. There's trees in there. There's debris all over them. So cleaning all that mess up is going to be a real chore in the coming days and weeks.
We've talked about governance a lot when it comes to Haiti and this disaster. There was supposed to be an election right before the hurricane hit.
Right.
Is the Haitian government now, which is an interim government, able to effectively coordinate recovery efforts, or are you all operating essentially independent of that situation?
No, there is a strong coordination mechanism in place, you know, and you're seeing different actors take different roles. I think definitely the UN and the NGOs are really trying and very much trying to support the government's platform as much as we can in terms of just, you know, really trying to help the response plan that's out there.
So, John Hassey, often in disasters of this kind, you know, I'm thinking of New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina, which is admittedly in a far different place than Haiti. But these things are often seen as an opportunity to rebuild in a new way that avoids problems of the past, slums, poor construction, lack of funds, water infrastructure. Is it too soon to be thinking about a vision for reconstruction in Haiti that helps avoid the next disaster?
This is the time to be thinking that way. So as we do respond, we're already thinking months and years out. We're already planning for what type of housing is going to be reconstructed? What are the water systems going to be looking like? You know, this area that was hit had one of the only working water systems in the whole country. And so we want to make sure that that gets back to hopefully even better than it was before. So this is the time to really be thinking about those things and how I hope that, the government and the UN and other actors aren't just thinking, okay, let's save lives, which we all are thinking. But really have that same perspective that many of us do is, what is it going to look like in a year, in 2 years?
John Hassey, I appreciate you talking to us today because I know you're busy. So when you leave this interview and you go out into Port-au-Prince, job one for you today, what is it?
It's making sure that all those supplies are continuing to go to get out there and to keep the logistic chain going so that our teams that are distributing and helping communities on the ground, that all of those supplies keep moving to them. Also, just taking care of our staff. Their families have lost their possessions, their homes, and so taking care of them, making sure that they can continue in this for the medium and the long term as well.
John Hassey, we wish you the very best in those efforts.
Thank you.
John Hassey is National Director of World Vision Haiti, spoke to me from Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, residents in North Carolina are still dealing with the damage from Hurricane Matthew there, with the expectation that the worst may not be over. Three rivers are expected to crest by the end of the week as water levels continue to rise there. And Governor Pat McCrory said Tuesday that flooding could linger for days. Jesse Clark has been covering the aftermath of the storm for member station WUNC. She spoke with two residents from a Section 8 housing complex in Fayetteville in the central part of North Carolina. Resident Angela Bodges didn't wait for a rescue. She helped an elderly neighbor get out before they were trapped.
The water flow was at least up to our chest. And me and Miss T, I'm not exactly sure her first name, we walked him up and out, which was a little difficult, but we made it.
What made you think of Mr. White? Like, how did that, now I guess in the moment when you decided, oh, I need to go get Mr. White, what went through your head there?
When we realized it was a now or never situation because of how fast the waters were, like, literally coming up the steps, we were like, let's go ahead and get out of here, because they said it could be a few hours before the rescue teams could even get here, and we didn't want to chance it being the water was moving as rapidly as it was.
And here's Vanessa Crowe, who with her partner and 8 children waited for hours on the second floor of the apartment while the first floor flooded. Crews finally rescued them by boat, and they returned home to find all of their belongings ruined.
Muddy, bad, all throughout my house. My dresser drawers, I mean, it got high. To where my dresser drawer, my mirror door, I mean, it tossed around my furniture even. It tossed my freezer around. I don't even understand how that happened because it was heavy. The water just got in there. Man, it's bad.
Voices from flooding in North Carolina, the aftermath of Hurricane Matthew, brought to us by Jesse Clark, reporter for North Carolina Public Radio in Chapel Hill. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, we're less than a month from Election Day. Down ballot from the presidential race, though, is the battle for power in Congress. Democrats think this is the year they can take back the Senate. Now, they need to pick up 5 seats for a majority, 4 if Hillary Clinton wins and installs Tim Kaine as the tiebreaker vice president. So between now and November 8th, we're going to be checking in on important races. We'll start today in Pennsylvania, where Republican incumbent Pat Toomey is running for his second term. His challenger is Democrat Katie McGinty. She's a newcomer to electoral politics, and she's attracted a lot of attention and outside money in Pennsylvania. Katie Meyer is Capitol Bureau Chief for WITA in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
Well, quick poll check. I was just going down the list. I mean, the recent polls in the last 10 days, one has McGinty up a little bit. Another one's a tie. Another one has Toomey up a little bit. I think it's safe to say this is a dead heat right now.
This is a very close race. Yeah, we've seen the polls sort of, they've been sporadic lately. It's much closer with the Senate race than it is with the Republican race or the presidential race right now. So, yeah, we're seeing it does come out to about a dead heat.
And so you mentioned the presidential race, and you have to, right, in the context of a race like this, because Hillary Clinton is running well ahead of Donald Trump in Pennsylvania. But Pat Toomey is also running well ahead of Trump. He's the Republican who's doing better in the state with voters so far than Trump is doing. How much of a challenge has this been for Pat Toomey to try to manage the Trump phenomenon?
Yeah, this has been a very tricky situation for Pat Toomey. And again, it's sort of interesting that we're seeing his polls come a little bit closer right now, because what we've been seeing in the past is him, you know, when Trump's numbers are up, his are up. When Trump's down, he's generally down. So he's closed the gap a little bit. But what Toomey's been doing, he's been taking sort of a tricky stance and saying, OK, I don't endorse Donald Trump. He has not formally endorsed him. But he's been saying that he would like to endorse him eventually, and he hasn't said that he won't vote for him. He hasn't really denounced him. You know, it's sort of just like that back and forth of not truly taking a position. And he stood by that even after, you know, this past weekend. There's been some scandals, as you might know. And Pat Toomey's still, he's sticking with that very, you know, will he, won't he position.
The non-endorsement support and the needle he's trying, right, to thread in Pennsylvania. Katie McGinty, at the same time, does not have the type of advantage, Katie Meyer, that you would expect a Democrat to have in Pennsylvania, especially a Democrat with a presidential candidate who's running so far ahead.
No, and you know, the thing is that Pat Toomey is, he's a well-known politician in Pennsylvania. He's fairly well liked. He's thought of as a pragmatic, you know, fiscal conservative, very unlike Trump. And Katie McGinty has much less name recognition. And when she is recognized, it's as being very similar to Hillary Clinton. And her positions are very similar. But yeah, she has not had as much experience in politics. And she's running again against an incumbent candidate who is not disliked in the state. So, yeah, it's been tough for her.
So at the same time in eastern Pennsylvania, you know, Democrats have been swarming all over eastern Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia and the Philly suburbs. Barack Obama, Michelle Obama, Joe Biden. Have they been shouting out
Katie McGinty while they're there in the way that we're used to seeing the up-ballot surrogates shout out the down-ballot candidates? Has that been happening?
Yeah, they've been shouting out McGinty and, you know, vice versa on the Trump side, even though Toomey has not been endorsed by or has not endorsed Donald Trump. He's been getting shout outs as well. So you do see that, you know, party support. But yeah, we'll see how it pans out.
Two Senate candidates in a critical swing state in Pennsylvania running below a contentious up ballot presidential race. One candidate trying to run from out from under a trailing Donald Trump. Katie McGinty trying to get just a little bit of the shine that Hillary Clinton appears to have, at least in the polls in eastern Pennsylvania. Katie Meyer, Capitol Bureau Chief for WITF in Harrisburg. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Two different looks at our criminal justice system now. In a minute, we'll talk to WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez, who's been comparing juveniles in prisons here with those abroad. But first, researchers at Texas State University in San Marcos found that police departments in California and Texas have failed to report hundreds of officer-involved shooting deaths as required by law in both of those states. Information on deaths like these is usually publicly available, but reporting the incidents puts them into state databases, which can provide information that researchers can use to study police-related shootings and hopefully prevent them in the future. Howard Williams is a former career officer and police chief in San Marcos, Texas. He's now a lecturer in the School of Criminal Justice at Texas State University, and he's co-author of the study.
Following the shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, the shooting of Michael Brown, so many of the pundits on TV were making comments about, we don't even know how many people police officers shoot and kill each year. And I started thinking, well, why don't we? I mean, how difficult can this be? Well, I found out it was considerably more difficult than I thought. But the point is, when you go and find all these open record sources that give you this kind of information, you find out that the federal reporting systems only include about 50% of the officer-involved shooting fatalities each year.
Is that because a lot of the reporting is voluntary in the first place?
Well, that's precisely what most of the problem is. But we then also compared the numbers that we found against the federal systems and against the state of Texas and the state of California. Those are the only two states that have required reporting to a central authority, in both cases, the Attorney General's office. And what we found was California is missing about 30% of the officer-involved shooting fatalities. Texas is missing about a fourth of them, about 25%.
You know, since police-involved shootings captured the attention of the nation, there have been increasing attempts by researchers to look into police records and try to determine if, in fact, African Americans, for instance, are more likely to be shot in an encounter with police. But it seems like the effort to really find the data behind this phenomenon that people care so much about, that effort is really hindered here if the incidents just aren't reported faithfully and consistently here.
Well, that is absolutely correct. If we don't have the data, we can't possibly go back and look at what gave rise to this shooting incident. We're looking at much bigger policy pictures than just what are the police doing. Are there issues in public health we need to change? Issues in mental health we need to change? Education? So many different roles that affect public behavior that ultimately the police are going to have to deal with.
Howard Williams, how long were you a cop?
I was a police officer for 36 years. I did 25 years with the Austin, Texas Police Department, and then was the chief in the San Marcos Police Department for 11 years.
And did you have encounters where you had to draw your weapon or fire it at a suspect?
I drew my weapon a few times over the course of the years. I never once fired a round other than at the practice range.
Did you have experience where other officers had to shoot somebody or did shoot somebody?
Oh, yes.
And
oh, yes.
What did those experiences tell you about how these incidents go down and why this missing data is so important to outsiders?
We kind of live with this concept of the split-second syndrome. In other words, we talk about officers having to make a determination within a split second. What are you going to do? And to some degree, that's true. But again, when you go back and look at the details of a shooting, there's always antecedent conditions and antecedent action that led up to that. When I was the chief here, we had four fatal shootings, two of which involved people with known mental health problems. A third one probably did, but he hadn't been diagnosed. You go back and look at what happened with them. It wasn't the police that let this person down. It was the mental health care industry that let him down somewhere along the way. Now, again, this is the much bigger public policy issue. When you look at these things, you start realizing it may be the cops who pulled the trigger who had to make that ultimate decision, but it wasn't the police who were in control of the antecedent conditions and behaviors that led up to it. And what we really need to do is find ways to keep the police from being in that position. Now, we're not so foolish as to believe that all shootings are going to go away. That's not going to happen. Unfortunately, there are going to always be times when it becomes necessary. But so many of these things, if we go back and study what actually happened in these shootings, we could find ways we could have interceded. Maybe we can pick out some patterns of things that we could address better to reduce the number of these shootings. I don't think they'll ever go away, but surely we can reduce them if we study them better. But again, we can't study them if we don't have the data on them.
Howard Williams, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Howard Williams is a lecturer in the School of Criminal Justice at Texas State University. He's also former police chief in San Marcos. And all this week, our co-producer, WNYC, is running a series called Kids in Prison. It's exploring what it's like to be a minor in an adult correctional facility. WNYC's Sarah Gonzalez spoke to inmates in New Jersey. That's where she met Jamal. Jamal was waived up. That means he was tried as an adult, and he's currently serving a 9-year sentence.
My public defender kept saying I was okay because I was too young to get waived up. I was 14. And then, yeah, I got waived up, but I didn't think I was going to be coming to prison.
And Jamal isn't alone. According to data from the New Jersey Administrative Office of the Court, he's one of 692 minors tried as adults in just the past 5 years. Critics argue that prosecuting minors as an adult can have a number of negative consequences. Not only does it disproportionately impact youths of color, but sentences are harsher than those given in the juvenile system. Consequently, this can lead to minors being housed in adult facilities where they have little access to developmentally appropriate resources or rehabilitation. Sarah Gonzalez set out to find a place that could be a model for change here. She sat down with John Hockenberry to talk about what she found out.
There is no state in the country that doesn't allow minors to be prosecuted as adults in some way. If I wanted to find a system that did not allow this, I would have to leave the country. And the Vera Institute of Justice pointed me to Germany as a country that the United States could maybe reasonably model, just because they're a big, large country, large economy. So I spent a week visiting prisons in Germany and speaking to the guy who runs prisons in Mecklenburg, Western Pomerania, which is a German state about the size of New Hampshire.
All right. So let's begin with the comparison. I mean, really, it's a straightforward comparison. You met a young man by the name of Jamal. Tell me about him.
So we're calling him Jamal. These are all minors when they committed their crimes. He was 14 when he committed his crime. And we found that of all of the people who are currently in an adult prison in New Jersey for a crime that they committed as a minor, the most common crime they committed was robbery. So Jamal is one of those kids. He's currently in an adult prison, and we had been talking for a couple months. He's been inside of solitary confinement because he had an electrical cord that he wasn't supposed to have. So he says he's doing 181 days for that, but he's able to call me every once in a while.
They say stuff like, oh, look, these effing juveniles, this and the third, they want to be tough. Now they're in a big boy prison. Let's see how tough they really is. They'll all be lined up, sitting there with their gloves on, stretching their gloves out, holding on to their mace can or their batons. Somebody look their way, what the F you're looking at, look for if I smack you, this and the third.
And that's a scene that Americans who watch television might find familiar, but if you go to Germany, nothing like that.
Well, so Jamal is talking here about the mace cans and the batons. And first of all, in Germany, if you are under the age of 21 and you commit a crime, you can be treated as a juvenile. And in some cases, even up to age 24, they'll allow you to be treated as a juvenile, which basically means that you go to a juvenile prison, not an adult prison. And everything about the juvenile system is different, right? It's more rehabilitative. Sentences are shorter for juveniles than they are for adults in New Jersey and in a lot of places. And besides the fact that minors cannot, under any circumstances, be prosecuted as adults in Germany, the main thing that stood out to me was just the way that they run their prison. So corrections officers in Germany don't get batons or mace or handcuffs or bulletproof and shankproof vests. They kind of, I described in my stories, they kind of look like mail carriers. And the prisons were very calm. And the liberty, I feel like the inmates had a lot more freedom. So everyone has their own cell and they are allowed to keep their piercings. They smoke cigarettes. They blast music. They all have jobs doing like metal work or farm work. There were horses everywhere and cows and goats. So I spoke to one inmate. His name, we're calling him Milan. He is doing 2.5 years for more than a dozen robberies.
What is this?
What?
This door.
That's the toilet.
Oh, you have a door for your toilet?
Of course.
Of course. Yeah. You should.
I think of course.
So this is Milan. When I interviewed him, we were in his room, which is actually, they don't call them cells, they call them rooms. And everything about it felt more like a college dorm room than a prison cell.
The contrast in Jersey would be two people to a cell and a toilet in the middle that's open, and you have to use the toilet as a table, basically.
Right. And, you know, I should say that if you are a minor in New Jersey and you are prosecuted as an adult, sentenced as adult, you do go to an adult prison, but they keep you away from adult inmates until you turn 18. So you're supposed to be out of sight and out of ear shot of the adult inmates. But Jamal and another inmate I spoke to, Trevor, the day that they turned 18, they were with, you know, they were in a cell with two men who had been in prison longer than Trevor had been alive. So that's one of the other reasons why we decided to go to Germany, because they basically say that there's nothing about the age of 18 that means you're an adult. It's just sort of this arbitrary line. And so they base it more on brain science, which suggests that you're closer to being a fully mature adult, ready for adult consequences around the age of 24.
So how did Milan convey to you the sense that he was actually in prison and not in some dorm?
The mission of Germany's prison system is just really different from the United States. Prisons there are not supposed to be punitive. The mission is not to punish inmates. It is to keep them in prison until they have demonstrated that they are ready to go back into society. So they have much shorter prison sentences. Like the longest a minor can get in Germany is 10 years. It doesn't matter what crime they commit, even if it was multiple murders. Jamal is doing 9 years for robberies where no one got hurt. And despite the fact that they all wake up in the morning and go to jobs and they get paid whatever minimum wage is in Germany for the jobs that they have in the prison, male and female inmates are together. And they basically say that prisons there are supposed to mirror the outside world as much as they possibly can. Having visited prisons in New Jersey and in other places, it felt very different to me, but Milan said, listen, like, it's still a prison.
One day of the week, 100%, I'm sad. Of course, I want to go to my mother at home. I want to eat there. My mother's cooking, and I want to eat. So if I call with her and she's crying, I'm sad too.
Two very different worlds, Germany and the United States, with very different lessons and insights. Sarah Gonzalez, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Hockenberry there, speaking with WNYC reporter Sarah Gonzalez. To hear more of the series Kids in Prison, head over to WNYC.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Staples, offering a variety of printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Now this is the plan. Get your ass to Mars.
That's right. That is, in fact, the plan, the presidential plan. President Obama, in an op-ed published on CNN, gave his support this week for American efforts to bring humans to Mars and back by the 2030s, with the ultimate goal of keeping humans there for an extended stay. Now, Mars will be at the top of the agenda tomorrow in Pittsburgh, where President Obama will host the first ever White House Frontiers Conference. And the administration's support is just part of a broader wave of enthusiasm for the Red Planet by NASA, by the movies, and private innovators like Elon Musk and SpaceX. At the end of August, six NASA-selected crew members completed their year-long mission in the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation Project, otherwise known as High Seas, not on Mars, on the Big Island in Hawaii, where they spent one full year simulating the first human habitat on Mars. Carmel Johnson was on that mission. She was a crew commander for High Seas and spoke to The Takeaway from her base back in Montana about what it would be really like for a small crew to go to Mars and to live there.
It's about changing your life entirely and living a life that's different than you would on Earth. And so you have to change the way that you deal with people with different situations and stressful situations. You have to change the way that you exercise, the way you cook food, the way you deal with having your own personal time or not having personal time. So adjusting to all of that and then being able to maintain your sanity while you have all these new things going on in your life is definitely a very challenging part of being on a mission like that.
Jason Kendall is here. He's adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Jason, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So we've seen this resurgence in the last couple of years of Mars scientific fantasizing in movies and books and popular culture. Of course, when the Matt Damon movie, The Martian, came out, we were aware that NASA helped coordinate the science of that storytelling. The government has a stake in the public getting excited about being part of missions like this.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the whole Matt, the movie, The Martian, the book were fantastic things. They're just, you couldn't have asked for something better to kind of help motivate people. I mean, my students, they talk about it. It's like something that's part of the culture now is actually going to Mars is something that people who are very young are actually thinking about. And I think that's fantastic.
What do you think President Obama is up to here? We have the Frontiers Conference in Pittsburgh.
Yep.
Mars is going to be a big part of it. I think that Barack Obama knows that we're going to Mars eventually, and he's looking forward to his legacy, and he wants to be the Jack Kennedy of Mars, the way that Kennedy spurred the country on to go to the moon, and now he gets the credit for it.
I think there's nothing exactly wrong with that. I think that he wants to be able to take that credit, but it really is going to be such a different venture than going to the moon, completely different. Going to the moon is only 200,000 miles away, roughly, and Mars is like millions of miles away, tens of millions, and people got to stay in space for months at a time and live on the surface of Mars for many months at a time and then fly back for months at a time. It's not a trivial venture. These are incredibly difficult technical things to solve, which lead to, of course, technical opportunities to solve. I mean, one of the major problems, I think that when I give public talks about Mars, one of the most interesting things is that people say, well, what's a big problem for astronauts? They have bone loss. So how to actually cure bone loss so that you actually, when you get to Mars, you don't step out of a spacecraft and crack your ankle because you got osteoporosis. Think about that. There's certain things that if we start sending people up into space and living in space and actually going to Mars or going to the moon, we're going to have a lot of things that we'll be solving for problems back on Earth as well.
So we have this outside competition model now of private companies like SpaceX. There are others that are gunning for Mars. Eventually, there's going to have to be a coordination of effort, right? How do you manage an independent actor with its own money, its own motivations, its own leader who has his own priorities, and a government effort with its scientific imperatives? At a certain point, the competition model is going to have to merge. It seems like it could be dicey.
I think it may very well be dicey, but I think that there's some good hope to it because there's a lot of models for that, I believe, in terms of legal aspects. It's like how government starts a certain venture and then basically passes it off to private ventures. And so there's a sense of actually trying to fold them in because at this time, there's no way for an individual company, I believe, to actually get to Mars on its own. Now they're going to need a significant amount of public help as well. And they all acknowledge that. But that's not a bad thing. It's like, well, okay, we'll give you this hand. We have the resources. We have the technology. We can build it and then send people off. And I think that eventually what we'll find is that the private ideas, the private options will be the things that people really are most interested in. Because it's like, well, bring back a rock from Mars and sell it here on Earth. You know, people having a piece of Mars for themselves. Or even mining rights on asteroids or Mars itself. Or even, you know, maybe in 100 years from today, a nice place to go vacation.
So this Frontiers Conference in Pittsburgh, we've, I think, fairly established that this is a legacy-building exercise for Barack Obama. But it's not only that. What are you most interested in scientifically or even logistically from a conference like this?
I think the first step for the logistics of the conference is setting down the people that are going to go. You really want to motivate people who are in their teens and their 20s to say, I want to be the next person that's going to get that rocket to Mars and get those people to Mars. Because the thing is that most people won't go to Mars. It's going to be a very small number of people that ever go to Mars. We're talking less than a few hundred in the whole history of humanity if we do go to Mars. So we have to build an enormous infrastructure of people that say, I want that to happen. And that's kind of like what people are doing with the high seas mission, where they go to Mars, where they go to, quote, Mars.
Mars in Hawaii.
Mars in Hawaii, exactly. So the whole Mars in Hawaii thing is, I'm going to go there, play like I'm on Mars. And those people aren't going to Mars. But what they're doing is they're setting the groundwork for what it's like to live on Mars. And they went through enormous hardships. And what they're telling us is they're showing us that people, when they really are, you know, when you're really smart and you're really dedicated and we're trying to actually do something that actually is way above what you ever thought you could do. So it's a wonderful class of people, a group of people that really are trying to make a lot of things happen.
You know, Jason Kendall, we started the show talking about political divisions, the election, which we do almost every day. We have to. This is a story that you're telling about national cohesion, the type of thing that an entire nation or even entire world
Yes.
can get behind.
Yes,
there's a real
is.
Opportunity there.
Yeah, it's a thing that I remember when I was very young and I saw this on the televisions watching the Apollo missions and hearing the reports about people watching the TVs all over the world. That'll happen again with Mars. When we set people on Mars, everything will stop. Everyone will watch. Everyone will be seeing the streaming video coming from their cam helmets. Everything will be on them. And the problems will just kind of, for that moment, for that glorious moment, will fade away. For that moment. But then they'll come back, as they always do. But I think you're right. I think they will. It's a unifier.
We'll realize that we're together here.
That's right. We'll look back on Earth, and it won't just be a disk like was from the moon. It'll be a tiny dot in the sky, barely visible.
Jason Kendall is adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University, friend of The Takeaway, of course. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, here's something to take with you today right here on Earth. Next Tuesday, October 18th, you can join me for a candid conversation about political correctness in this election year. I'm going to be talking with young voters about how political correctness is changing the notions of free speech and tolerance. And if you're in New York, New Jersey, or the Connecticut area, you can join us in the green space. This is all part of our unconvention coverage. You can buy tickets by visiting us at facebook.com/thetakeaway or at thegreenspace.org. That's GREN space.org. You can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. And thank you so much for listening. John Hockenberry will be back tomorrow. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.